Isabel had no hidden motive in wishing Ralph not to dine with her. It simply struck her that for some days past she had consumed an inordinate quantity of his time. She had, moreover, a great fondness for intervals of solitude. However, seated towards 9 o'clock in the dim illumination of Pratt's Hotel and trying to read, she was interrupted by the waiter presenting her with a card bearing the name of Mr. Caspar Goodwood.
"Shall I show the gentleman up, ma'am?"
Isabel hesitated and then nodded. Caspar Goodwood was accordingly the next moment shaking hands with her. "How did you know I was here?" Isabel asked.
"Miss Stackpole let me know. She wrote me that you would probably be at home alone this evening."
"Henrietta never told me," said Isabel, motioning her guest to sit down.
"Is it so disagreeable to you to see me?"
Isabel made no reply. The sense of Henrietta Stackpole's treachery was strong within her. "Henrietta is certainly not a model of all the delicacies," she exclaimed bitterly.
"The fault's mine as much as hers. I've been hoping every day for an answer to my letter. You might have written me a few lines."
"It wasn't the trouble of writing that prevented me. My silence was an intention," Isabel said. "I thought that if you were capable of banishing me from your mind for a few months, we should be on good terms again."
"I'm capable of nothing with regard to you," said the young man, "but just of being infernally in love with you."
"Think of me or not, as you find most possible. Only leave me alone."
"Until when?"
"Well, for a year or two."
"Which do you mean? Between 1 year and two, there's all the difference in the world."
"Call it two, then," said Isabel.
"And what shall I gain by that?"
"If you make the sacrifice, you'll have all my admiration."
"I don't care a cent for your admiration, with nothing to show for it. When will you marry me? That's the only question."
"Never, if you go on worrying me to death." Caspar Goodwood flushed. Isabel could see that her sharpness had at last penetrated. "Why do you make me say such things to you?" she cried in a trembling voice. "I only want to be gentle, to be thoroughly kind. But I really don't want to marry or talk about it at all now. I've a perfect right to feel that way, and it's no kindness to a woman to urge her against her will. I think you had better go home."
"May I not see you again?"
"I return in a day or two to my uncle's."
"I received an invitation to your uncle's more than a week ago, and I declined it."
Isabel betrayed surprise. "From whom was your invitation?"
"From Mr. Ralph Touchett. I declined it because I had not your authorization to accept it. The suggestion appeared to come from Miss Stackpole."
"Henrietta really goes too far." Isabel gave a little shudder of dismay at the thought that Lord Warburton and Mr. Goodwood might have met at Gardencourt.
"When you leave your uncle, where do you go?"
her companion asked. "I'm traveling abroad with my aunt, to Florence and other places."
"So you simply want to travel for 2 years," said the young man. "I'm quite willing to wait 2 years. If it interests you to see different countries, I shall be delighted to help you in any way in my power."
"You're very generous. That's nothing new to me. The best way to help me will be to put as many 100 miles of sea between us as possible."
"Well, then, I'll go home. But I'll come back wherever you are 2 years hence,"
the young man returned with characteristic grimness. "Ah, remember, I promise nothing," cried Isabel.
"You'll get very sick of your independence."
"Perhaps I shall. When that day comes, I shall be very glad to see you. But I must leave you now." She rose and opened the door and passed into the other room. She stood still a moment, listening, and at last she heard Caspar Goodwood walk out of the sitting room. Isabel was sitting reading when Henrietta Stackpole returned from her dinner.
"Has he been here, dear?"
Henrietta yearningly asked.
"You acted very wrongly, Henrietta.
I acted for the best, and I trust you gave Mr. Goodwood some hope.
I don't see why I should tell you anything, Henrietta. I can't trust you. But since you're so much interested, I won't conceal from you that Mr. Goodwood returns immediately to America.
You don't mean to say you've sent him off?
Henrietta almost shrieked. I asked him to leave me alone, and I ask you the same. Miss Stackpole glittered for an instant with dismay, and then took off her bonnet.
Well, Isabel, if I didn't know you, I might think you were heartless.
Henrietta then proceeded to tell her that she had determined not to return to Garden Court, but to await in London the arrival of the invitation that Mr. Bantling had promised would be sent from his sister, Lady Pensil. Henrietta felt sure that some time spent with Lady Pensil would be most productive, and told Isabel to look out for her impressions in the Interviewer. Isabel was alone the following morning when Ralph Touchett was announced. As soon as he came into the room, she could see that something was wrong, and he told her he was returning to Garden Court as his father had had an attack of his old malady.
I have an appointment with the great doctor, Sir Matthew Hope, at 12, and I will be catching the train at 2:30. You can come with me or remain here a few days longer, exactly as you prefer.
I shall certainly go with you, Isabel returned. I'm very fond of my uncle, and I should like to be near him.
That's very well. After his son, he's your greatest admirer.
Isabel welcomed this assurance, but she gave secretly a small sigh of relief at the thought that Mr. Touchett was one of those admirers who couldn't propose to marry her. When Ralph returned at 2 o'clock, he found Miss Stackpole in the sitting room. She gave her condolences about his father and then voiced her concern about Isabel.
"What's her last misdemeanor?" asked Ralph.
"Well, Mr. Goodwood was here last night."
Ralph opened his eyes. He even blushed a little, a sign of an emotion somewhat acute. But he gave Miss Stackpole a diplomatic answer.
"I should have thought that, with the views you expressed to me the other day, this would satisfy you perfectly."
"Well, it was all very well as far as it went.
It was a little plot of mine. I let him know that we were in London, and then I sent him a word when he would likely find Isabel alone." Ralph's face lighted with relief. Henrietta went on.
"Well, he came to see her, but he might as well have stayed away."
"Isabel was cruel?"
"I don't exactly know what passed between them, but she sent him back to America."
"Poor Mr. Goodwood."
"You don't say that as if you felt it. I don't believe you care."
"Ah," said Ralph, "you must remember that I've never seen this interesting young man."
"Well, I shall see him, and I shall tell him not to give up. If I didn't believe Isabel would come round," Miss Stackpole added, "well, I'd give her up."
Ralph and Isabel made the journey to Garden Court in almost unbroken silence. They were met at the station by a servant who told them that Mr. Touchett's condition was unchanged. Ralph went to see his father, and Isabel went to her room. When, after an hour, she came downstairs in search of her aunt, she heard music coming from the salon. Thinking that this was Ralph, and that his anxiety about his father had been relieved, the girl made her way toward the source of the harmony. But the person seated at the piano was not Ralph. It was a lady unknown to Isabel. She played the piano remarkably well, with a discretion of her own. She looked up as Isabel approached. She was about 40 years old, and not pretty, though her expression charmed.
"Pardon me," she said. "But are you the niece, the young American?"
"I'm my aunt's niece."
"That's very well. We're compatriots," said the lady, getting up, smiling. "I'm very glad you've come back. I've heard a great deal about you."
"From whom have you heard about me?"
"From your uncle. I've been here 3 days, and before he was taken ill, he talked of you constantly." As you didn't know me, that must have rather bored you.
No, it made me want to know you.
Mrs. Touchett appeared at this time and greeted her niece. Questioned about her husband, she was unable to say he was better, but they were waiting for Sir Matthew Hope.
I suppose you two ladies have made acquaintance, she pursued. If you haven't, I recommend you do so, as at the moment you're not likely to have much society but each other.
I know nothing about you but that you're a great musician, Isabel said to the visitor.
There's a great deal more than that to know, said Mrs. Touchett dryly.
A very little of it, I'm sure, will content Miss Archer, the lady exclaimed with a light laugh. I'm an old friend of your aunt's. I've lived much in Florence. I'm Madame Merle.
She's not a foreigner, in spite of her name, said Mrs. Touchett. She was born on Brooklyn.
Isabel looked at the visitor. She was a tall, fair woman with a classical look. She would have taken her for a German, a baroness, or a countess. Her manner expressed repose and confidence. It would never have been supposed that she had come into the world in Brooklyn. When Isabel came into the drawing room before dinner that evening, she found Ralph standing alone before the fireplace.
"Pray, who is this, Madame Merle?" she inquired.
"The cleverest woman I know, not excepting yourself."
"Is that why you invited her?"
"I didn't invite her. I didn't know she was here. She's a friend of my mother's. She's the one person in the world whom my mother very much admires."
"Well, she's very charming," said Isabel, "and she plays beautifully."
"She does everything beautifully. She's complete."
Isabel looked at her cousin a moment. "You don't like her."
"On the contrary, I was once in love with her."
"And she didn't care for you?"
"How can we have discussed such things? Monsieur Merle was then living."
"Is he dead now?"
"So she says."
"Don't you believe her?"
"Yes, the husband of Madame Merle would be likely to pass away."
But the discussion was interrupted by the arrival of the lady who was the topic of it. She came rustling in quickly, and Ralph offered her his arm with the exaggerated alertness of a man who was no longer a lover.
Ralph returned to his father's room after dinner. The nurse had gone to supper, and he alone was in charge.
"Who is that with me? Is it my son?"
the old man asked.
"Yes, Daddy."
"And is there no one else?"
"No one else."
"I want to talk a little."
"Won't it tire you?" Ralph demurred.
"It won't matter if it does. I shall have a long rest. I want to talk about you."
Ralph drew nearer to the bed.
"You had better select a brighter topic." "You were always bright. I should like so much to think you'd do something. You'll be very well off."
"Yes, I know that. But it's impossible for a man in my state of health to spend much money."
"The best thing you can do when I'm gone is to marry."
Ralph said nothing. He had foreseen what his father was coming to. This suggestion was by no means fresh.
"What do you think of your cousin?"
his father continued softly. At this, Ralph started.
"Do I understand you to propose that I marry Isabel? Don't you like her?"
"Yes, very much. I like Isabel very much."
"Well, I know she likes you, and she would be good to you. I have thought a great deal about it."
"So have I," said Ralph.
"You are in love with her, then?" "No, I'm not in love with her. But I should be if
certain things were different." I believe, on the whole, that people had better not marry their cousins, and that people in an advanced state of pulmonary disorder had better not marry at all."
The old man raised his weak hand.
"But we're all each other's cousins, and if we stopped at that, the human race would die out. It's just the same with your bad lung. You're a great deal better than you used to be. All you want is to lead a natural life. It's a great deal more natural to marry a pretty young lady that you're in love with than it is to remain single on false principles."
"I'm not in love with Isabel, Daddy. I take a great interest in her, but not the sort of interest you desire. I shall not live many years, but I hope I shall live long enough to see her do something with herself. She wants to see the world, for instance. I should like to put a little wind in her sails and money in her purse."
"Ah, I've thought of that,"
said the old man.
"I've left her £5,000.
"That's capital. But I should like you to do a little more. I should like you to give Isabel half of my inheritance."
"To do what she likes with?"
"Absolutely."
"And without an equivalent of her marrying someone or other?"
"It's just to do away with anything of that sort that I make my suggestion. If she has an easy income, she'll never have to marry for a support. She wishes to be free, and your bequest will make her free."
"But doesn't it occur to you that a young lady with so much money may fall victim to fortune hunters?"
"That's a risk, but I think it's small, and I'm prepared to take it."
"But I don't see why you appeal to me. The money will be yours, and you can easily give it to her yourself."
Ralph openly stared.
"Oh, dear father, I can't offer Isabel money."
The old man gave a groan.
"Oh, don't tell me you're not in love with her."
As Mrs. Touchett had foretold, Isabel and Madame Merle were thrown much together during the illness of their host, so that if they had not become intimate, it would have been almost a breach of good manners. Their manners were of the best, but in addition to this, they happened to please each other. Certainly, on the whole, Isabel had never encountered a more agreeable and interesting figure than Madame Merle. She was charming, sympathetic, intelligent, cultivated. She spent her days at Gardencourt writing to her numerous acquaintances, painting, or playing the piano. She was never idle, for when engaged in none of these ways, she was either reading — she appeared to Isabel to read everything important — or playing patience with the cards, or talking with her fellow inmates. She exhibited a great interest in Isabel's history, sentiments, opinions, prospects. She made her chatter and listened to her chatter with infinite good nature.
"Tell me more about America," she would often say to Isabel. "You never tell me enough. Here I've been since I was brought here as a helpless child, and it's ridiculous how little I know about that splendid, dreadful, funny country. There are a great many of us like that in these parts, and I must say I think we're a wretched set of people. You should live in your own land. Whatever it may be, you have your natural place there. Oh, look at poor Ralph Touchett. Fortunately, he has a consumption. I say fortunately, because it gives him something to do. You can say, 'Oh, Mr. Touchett, he takes care of his lungs. He knows a great deal about climates.' But without that, what would he represent? Mr. Touchett, an American who lives in Europe. The worst case, I think, is a friend of mine, a countryman of ours who lives in Italy, and who is one of the most delightful men I know. Some day you must meet him. He's Gilbert Osmond. He lives in Florence. That's all one can say about him. He's exceedingly clever, but he has no career, no position, no fortune, no past, no future, no anything. Oh, yes, he paints. But he has a little girl, a dear little girl. If it were a career to be an excellent father, he'd be very distinguished. But tell me what they do in America.
pursued Madame Merle, who, it must be observed parenthetically, did not deliver herself all at once of these reflections. Madame Merle did not remain to the end, as the issue of poor Mr. Touchett's malady had now come frankly to be designated. She was under pledges to other people which had at last to be redeemed, and she left Gardencourt with the understanding that she should see Mrs. Touchett again before quitting England. Her parting with Isabel was even more like the beginning of a friendship than their meeting had been. "I'm going to 6 places in succession, but I shall see no one I like so well as you," she said, kissing her. "I've made a great exception for you. You must remember that and reward me by believing in me." Our young lady, after this, was much alone. She saw her aunt and her cousin only at meals.
"If I had foreseen this, I'd not have proposed your coming abroad now," Mrs. Touchett said to Isabel. "I'd have waited until next year."
"But then I should never have known my uncle."
"That's very well, but it was not that you might know your uncle that I brought you to Europe."
A perfectly veracious speech, but, as Isabel thought, not as perfectly timed. She had leisure to think of this and other matters as she took a solitary walk every day. Among the subjects that engaged her attention were the adventures of her friend Miss Stackpole, with whom she was in regular correspondence. Henrietta's career, however, was not so successful as might have been wished. The invitation from Lady Pensil, for mysterious reasons, had never arrived, and poor Mr. Bantling had suggested that perhaps she should try a change of scene and write about French life. A few days later, Henrietta wrote that she had decided to go to Paris at the end of the week. She would wait in Paris until Isabel should arrive. Isabel communicated several passages from this correspondence to Ralph.
"It seems to me she's doing very well," he said, "going over to Paris with an ex-lancer. If she wants something to write about, she has only to describe that episode."
"It's not conventional, certainly," Isabel answered. "But if you mean that, as far as Henrietta is concerned, it's not perfectly innocent, you're very much mistaken. You'll never understand Henrietta."
"Pardon me, I understand her perfectly. I'm afraid, however, that Bantling doesn't. He may have some surprises."
Isabel was by no means sure of this, but she abstained from expressing further doubt. One afternoon, less than a week after Madame Merle's departure, Isabel was seated in the library, reading. There was a great stillness in the house. It was so great that when she at last heard a soft, slow step on the carpet, she was almost startled by the sound. She looked up and saw Ralph Touchett standing there, with his hands in his pockets, but with a face absolutely void of its usual latent smile.
"It's all over," said Ralph.
"Do you mean that my uncle... Oh, my poor Ralph," she gently wailed, putting out her 2 hands to him. Some fortnight after this, Madame Merle arrived in a hansom cab at the house in Winchester Square. Mrs. Touchett presently received her and intimated in a few words that condolences might be taken for granted.
"I know what you're going to say. He was a very good man. But I know it better than anyone, because I gave him more chance to show it. In that, I think I was a good wife." Mrs. Touchett added that at the end her husband apparently recognized this fact. "He has treated me most liberally. He has left me this house, but of course I shall sell it. As you know, my house in Florence is much better. Ralph, of course, has Gardencourt, and he's naturally left very well off. But there's one remarkable clause in my husband's will," Mrs. Touchett added. "He has left my niece a fortune."
"A fortune?" Madame Merle softly repeated.
"Isabel steps into something like £70,000.
Madame Merle clasped her hands. "Oh,
The clever creature!
Mrs. Touchett gave her a quick look.
What do you mean?
For an instant, Madame Merle's color rose. It certainly is clever to achieve such results without an effort.
My dear friend, there assuredly was no effort. Isabel never dreamed, I'm sure, of my husband's doing anything for her.
And what does Ralph think of it?
He left for the Riviera before the will was read, used up by his fatigue and anxiety. But he's not in the least addicted to looking after Number One.
It depends upon whom he regards as Number One, said Madame Merle.
And she remained thoughtful a moment, her eyes bent.
Am I not to see your happy niece?
She asked at last.
You may see her, but you'll not be struck with her being happy. She has looked so solemn these last 3 days.
Isabel came in shortly, looking pale and grave. But the smile of her brightest moments came into her face as she saw Madame Merle. This lady went forward, and after looking at her for a moment, kissed her as she had at Gardencourt. This was the only allusion the visitor, in her great good taste, made for the present to her young friend's inheritance. Mrs. Touchett had no intention of staying in London. She left the house to be disposed of by an auctioneer and took her departure for the Continent. She was accompanied on this journey by Isabel, who now had plenty of leisure to weigh up the windfall on which Madame Merle had covertly congratulated her. The failure to rise to immediate joy was indeed but brief. The girl presently made up her mind that to be rich was a virtue because it was to be able to do. Just now, it is true, there was not much to do, once she had sent off checks to Lily and Edith. But she was thankful for the quiet months which her aunt's fresh widowhood compelled them to spend together. Mrs. Touchett rarely changed her plans, and having intended before her husband's death to spend the winter in Paris, saw no reason to deprive Isabel of this advantage. Though they would live in great retirement, she might still present her niece, informally, to the little circle of her fellow countrymen dwelling near the Champs-Élysées. With many of these amiable colonists, Mrs. Touchett was intimate. She shared their expatriation, their convictions, their pastimes. Isabel saw them arrive with a great deal of assiduity at her aunt's hotel. She made up her mind that their lives were, though luxurious, inane, and incurred some disfavor by expressing this view to her aunt. Mrs. Touchett thought this comment worthy of Henrietta Stackpole. The two ladies had found Henrietta in Paris, and Isabel constantly saw her. One of Mrs. Touchett's visitors was a young man with whom Isabel had a good deal of conversation. Mr. Edward Rosier was a native to New York, and had been brought up in Paris by his father, who, as it happened, had been a friend of the late Mr. Archer. He was a very gentle and gracious youth, with what are called cultivated tastes. He collected old china, Louis XV furniture, enamels and lace, and he frequented the best shops and hotels. He had once spent a couple of months in the United States, but considered Europe to be the place for a gentleman. Henrietta Stackpole thought him most unnatural, and read him long lectures on the duties of an American citizen. Henrietta was, at this time, more than ever addicted to fine criticism, for her conscience had been freshly alarmed as regards Isabel. She had not congratulated this young lady on her augmentations, and begged to be excused from doing so. "If Mr. Touchett had consulted me about leaving you the money," she frankly asserted, "I'd have said to him, never."
"I see," Isabel had answered. "You think it will prove a curse in disguise?
Perhaps it will."
"Leave it to someone you care less for. That's what I'd have said."
Mrs. Touchett, before arriving in Paris, had fixed the day for her departure,
and by the end of February had begun to travel southward. She interrupted her journey to pay a visit to her son, who had been spending the winter at San Remo. "I want to ask you something," Isabel said to this young man the day after her arrival. "Did you know your father intended to leave me so much money?" Ralph gazed a little more fixedly at the Mediterranean.
"What does it matter, my dear Isabel, whether I knew?"
"So you did know?"
"Yes, he told me."
"What did he do it for?" she asked abruptly.
"Why, as a kind of compliment on your so beautifully existing."
"He liked me too much."
"Well, that's a way we all have."
"If I believed that, I should be very unhappy. Do you think it good for me suddenly to be made so rich? Henrietta doesn't."
"Oh, hang Henrietta," said Ralph coarsely. "If you ask me, I'm delighted at it."
"Is that why your father did it? For your amusement?"
"I differ with Miss Stackpole,"
Ralph went on more gravely.
"I think it very good for you to have means."
Isabel stared at him. "I wonder whether you know what's good for me, or whether you care."
"If I know, depend upon it, I care. But don't ask yourself so much whether this or that is good for you. Live as you like best. Most things are good for you. The exceptions are very rare, and a comfortable income's not one of them."
Ralph paused, smiling.
"Spread your wings. Rise above the ground."
"But a large fortune means freedom, and I'm afraid of that. It's such a fine thing, and one should make such a good use of it, but it's a constant effort. I'm not sure it's not a greater happiness to be powerless."
"For weak people, I've no doubt it's a greater happiness."
"And how do you know I'm not weak?" Isabel asked.
"Ah,"
Ralph answered with a flush that the girl noticed.
"If you are, I'm awfully sold."
In early May, some 6 months after old Mr. Touchett's death, a small group was gathered in one of the many rooms of an ancient villa crowning an olive-muffled hill outside Florence. In an apartment, one of the several into which the villa was divided, a gentleman was seated in company with a young girl and two good sisters from a religious house. The apartment was luxuriously furnished, with faded hangings of damask and tapestry, chests and cabinets of carved and time-polished oak, and deep, well-padded chairs. There were books in profusion, and a few small, elaborate pictures, chiefly in watercolor. One of these productions stood on an easel before which the young girl had placed herself. The gentleman was conversing with the two nuns, but at the same time his eyes rested gravely on the slim, small figure of their quiet charge. He was a man of 40, with an extremely modeled and composed face and a fair waxed mustache that suggested he was a gentleman who studied style.
"Well, my dear, what do you think of the painting?" he asked the young girl.
"It's very pretty, Papa. Did you make it yourself?"
"Certainly I made it. Don't you think I'm clever?"
"Yes, Papa, very clever." She smiled sweetly at her father.
"Why don't you go and pick some flowers for the good ladies?"
The child turned to the elder of the sisters. "May I, Mama Catherine?"
"Obey, Monsieur, your father, my child," said the sister, blushing.
The child, satisfied with this authorization, descended into the garden and was lost from sight.
"You don't spoil them,"
said her father gaily. "For everything they must ask leave. That's our system."
"I've no doubt it's excellent. I sent my daughter to you to see what you'd make of her. And now at 15 she seems to me very gentille."
"We love her very much," said the sister. "We shall be sorry to lose her."
"It's not certain you'll lose her. Nothing's settled yet," their host rejoined quickly. "I wish you could keep her always."
"Oh, monsieur," said the elder sister, getting up. "Good as she is, she's made for the world." At this point, the young girl returned with two large bunches of roses. "They will soon die," she cried. "I wish I could give you something that would last." "You've given us a good memory of yourself, my daughter. That will last." Their host,
while the sisters exchanged kisses with his daughter, went forward to open the door to the antechamber, but as he did so, he gave a slight exclamation. A lady had just been admitted by a servant. The lady went into the room and found herself confronted with the two nuns and their pupil. The young girl gave a soft cry.
"Oh, Madame Merle!"
The visitor had been slightly startled, but her manner was none the less gracious.
"Yes, it's Madame Merle, come to welcome you home."
"This lady's a great friend of ours," the host told the sisters. "You will have seen her at the convent. She'll help me to decide whether Pansy shall return to you at the end of the holidays."
"I hope you'll decide in our favor, madame."
"That's Mr. Osmond's pleasantry," replied Madame Merle. "I decide nothing." The sisters embraced Pansy and then followed Mr. Osmond to the door. Pansy made to follow, but Madame Merle called to her.
"Stay with me, dear child, while your father shows the good ladies to their carriage."
Pansy stared, disappointed yet not protesting. She was evidently impregnated with the idea of submission, which was due to anyone who took the tone of authority.
"Shall you miss Mother Catherine?" Madame Merle asked.
"Yes, when I think of her."
"Try then not to think of her. Perhaps some day you'll have another mother."
"I don't think that's necessary," Pansy said. "I had more than 30 mothers at the convent."
As she heard her father returning, she moved toward the door.
"Why didn't you come and see the last of Mama Catherine?"
Mr. Osmond asked abruptly. Pansy hesitated, glancing at Madame Merle.
"I asked her to stay with me."
"Ah, that was better,"
Osmond conceded, and he dropped into a chair.
"Why don't you go into the garden, little one, and pluck a flower or two for Madame Merle?"
"That's just what I wanted to do," Pansy exclaimed.
When the child left the room, Osmond addressed himself to his companion.
"You're looking particularly well."
"I think I always look the same," said Madame Merle.
"You always are the same. You're a wonderful woman."
"Yes, I think I am."
"But why are you here?"
Osmond asked.
"I've come to Florence to meet some friends who have lately arrived."
"That reason's characteristic. You're always doing something for your friends."
"I'd like to do something for you," said Madame Merle, looking at him with a certain courage. "There's a friend of mine I should like you to meet."
"What good will it do me?"
Madame Merle smiled.
"It will amuse you."
"Who then is your friend?"
"She's a niece of Mrs. Touchett."
"A niece? The word suggests youth and ignorance."
"Yes, she's young, 23 years old. I met her for the first time in England several months ago. I like her immensely, and you'll do the same."
"Is she beautiful, clever, rich, universally intelligent, and unprecedentedly virtuous?" "It's only on those conditions that I care to make her acquaintance."
"Miss Archer fills all your requirements."
"More or less, of course."
"No, quite literally. She's beautiful, accomplished, generous, and, for an American, well-born. She also has a handsome fortune."
Mr. Osmond listened to this in silence, his eyes on his informant.
"Come and see me this week," continued Madame Merle. "I'm staying at Mrs. Touchett's, Palazzo Crescentini, and the girl will be there."
"Did you say she was rich?"
"She has £70,000.
"Satisfactory woman. I mean you." "And did you say she has looks?"
"Yes, but I won't say it again, lest you be disappointed. Come and make a beginning. That's all I ask of you."
"A beginning of what?"
Madame Merle was silent a little.
"I want you, of course, to marry her."
"The beginning of the end. Well, I'll see for myself."
Merle, who had come to Florence on Mrs. Touchett's arrival and was staying at Palazzo Crescentini, spoke to Isabel afresh about Gilbert Osmond. She spoke of her old friend as one of the cleverest and most agreeable men, well, in Europe, simply. He wasn't a professional charmer, far from it. But if he cared or was interested, then one felt his cleverness and his distinction. At any rate, one shouldn't attempt to live in Italy without making a friend of Gilbert Osmond. For the moment, though, Isabel was happy just to be in Florence, and Ralph found it a joy that renewed his own early passion to act as a guide to his eager young kinswoman. In the clear May mornings before the formal breakfast, this repast at Mrs. Touchett's was served at 12 o'clock, Isabel wandered with her cousin through the narrow and somber Florentine streets. She went to the galleries and palaces. She looked at the pictures and statues that had hitherto been great names to her. She performed all those acts of mental prostration in which, on a first visit to Italy, youth and enthusiasm freely indulge. Gilbert Osmond came to see Madame Merle, who presented him to Isabel. The young lady took on this occasion little part in the talk. Mrs. Touchett was not present, and these two had it, for the effect of brilliancy, all their own way. They talked of the Florentine, the Roman, the cosmopolite world, and might have been distinguished performers figuring for charity. Isabel made no attempt to join in. There was something in the visitor that checked her and held her in suspense. Yet before he went, she had to speak.
"Madame Merle," he said, "consents to come to my hilltop next week and drink tea in my garden. It would give me much pleasure if you would come with her. The view is considered rather good, and I have many paintings, and I should be so happy if you could know my daughter."
Isabel replied that she would be pleased to accompany Madame Merle. Upon this assurance, the visitor took his leave, after which Isabel fully expected her friend would scold her for having been so stupid. But to her surprise, that lady said, "You were so charming, my dear." These words caused Isabel the first feeling of displeasure she had known this ally to excite. "That's more than I intended," she answered coldly. "I'm under no obligation that I know of to charm Mr. Osmond." Madame Merle perceptibly flushed. "My dear child, I didn't speak for him, poor man. I spoke for yourself. I thought you liked him." "I did," said Isabel honestly. "But I don't see what that matters either." "Everything that concerns you matters to me," Madame Merle returned with her weary nobleness. Whatever Isabel's obligations may have been to Mr. Osmond, she found them sufficient to ask Ralph sundry questions about him.
"Do I know him?" said her cousin. "Oh, yes, I know him, but not well. I've never cultivated his society, and he apparently has never found mine indispensable to his happiness. He's a vague, unexplained American who has lived here some 30 years. I don't know his family, his origin. He used to live in Rome, but I remember hearing him say that Rome had grown vulgar. He has a great dread of vulgarity. That's his special line. He hasn't any other that I know of. He lives on his income, which I suspect of not being vulgarly large. He married young and lost his wife, and I believe he has a daughter. He also has a sister who's married to some small count or other. She's nicer than him, but rather impossible. I don't think I recommend you know her. But why don't you ask Madame Merle about these people?"
"I want your opinion as well as hers, and I've promised to pay him a visit."
"Pay him a visit?"
"To see his view, his pictures, his daughter. Madame Merle's to take me."
"Oh, with Madame Merle you may go anywhere," said Ralph. "She knows none but the best people."
Isabel said no more about Mr. Osmond, but she presently remarked to her cousin that she was not satisfied with his tone about Madame Merle.
"I speak of Madame Merle exactly as I speak to her, with an even exaggerated respect."
"Exaggerated, precisely. That's what I complain of."
But Madame Merle's merits are exaggerated. She's too good, too clever, too learned, too everything. I confess to you that she acts on my nerves.
Isabel looked hard at her cousin, and then she asked him if he knew anything that was not to the honor of her brilliant friend.
Nothing. Nothing whatever. Don't you see? That's just what I mean. She's just too perfect.
That's why I like her so much.
Well, since you wish to see the world, you couldn't have a better guide.
I suppose you mean by that she's worldly.
Worldly? No, said Ralph. She's the great round world itself.
Isabel's visit to Mr. Osmond's hilltop took place on a soft afternoon in the full maturity of the Tuscan spring. The companions drove out of the Roman gate and wound through the blossoming orchards until they reached the villa. Mr. Osmond met them and ushered Isabel with her conductress into the apartment. While Isabel talked a little with their host, Madame Merle went forward familiarly and greeted two persons who were seated in the salon. One of these was Pansy. The other was a lady whom Mr. Osmond indicated to Isabel as his sister, the Countess Gemini. Pansy made Isabel a little conventional curtsy. The Countess Gemini simply nodded without getting up. Isabel could see she was a woman of high fashion. Her attire was bristling with elegance, and she had the most affected manner.
"It's only because I knew you were visiting today that I came myself. I don't often come to see my brother. I make him come and see me. This hill of his is impossible. Really, Osmond, you'll be the ruin of my horses some day. But don't sit there," she said, directly addressing Isabel. "That chair's not what it looks. There are some very good seats here, but there are also some horrors."
"I don't see any horrors anywhere," Isabel returned, looking about her at the paintings and ornaments. "Everything seems to me beautiful and precious."
"I've a few good things," Mr. Osmond allowed. "Indeed, I've nothing very bad, but I've not what I should have liked."
"You'd have liked a few things from the Uffizi and Pitti. That's what you'd have liked," said Madame Merle.
Mr. Osmond had not heard her. He seemed to be thinking of what he could say to Isabel.
"Won't you have some tea? You must be very tired," he said at last.
"I'm not tired. What have I done to tire me?" Isabel felt a certain need of being very direct.
"You'll be tired when you go home if he shows you all his knick-knacks and gives you a lecture on each," said the Countess Gemini.
"I'm not afraid of that. At least I shall have learned something."
"Very little, I suspect. But my sister's afraid of learning anything," said Gilbert Osmond, sitting down beside Pansy.
Mr. Osmond talked of many things. Madame Merle had said he could be agreeable when he chose, and today, after a little, Isabel felt he appeared not only to have chosen, but to have determined. He talked of Florence, of Italy, of its cultures, of the pleasure of living in that country. Eventually, Madame Merle proposed to the Countess Gemini that they should go into the garden. Isabel had got up on the assumption that they too were to go into the garden, but her host stood there with no apparent inclination to leave the room, his hands in the pocket of his jacket and his daughter clinging to his arm. Isabel waited, with a certain unuttered contentedness, to have her movements directed. She liked Mr. Osmond's talk, his company. She had what always gave her a very private thrill, the consciousness of a new relation. He moved across to one of the pictures and related some curious facts about it. She looked at the other works of art, and he gave her such further information as might appear most acceptable to a young lady making a call on a summer afternoon. His pictures, his medallions and tapestries were interesting, but after a while, Isabel felt the owner much more so. He resembled no one she had ever seen. He was a specimen apart. It was not so much what he said and did, but rather what he withheld.
Tea was served in the garden, and Pansy was sent to assist in the preparation. As Isabel had not yet been made acquainted with the view, Mr. Osmond directed her steps into the garden without more delay. The sun had got low, and the golden light took a deeper tone on the mountains. The scene had an extraordinary charm.
"You seem so pleased that I think you can be trusted to come back,"
Osmond said, as he led his companion to one of the angles of the terrace.
"Although Madame Merle spoke of your having some plan of going around the world."
"I'm rather ashamed of my plans. I make a new one every day."
"I don't see why you should be ashamed. It's the greatest of pleasures," he said, smiling.
The Countess Gemini, sitting with Madame Merle, watched as her brother stood on the terrace talking to Isabel.
"My dear," she then observed to her companion, "you'll excuse me if I don't congratulate you."
"Very willingly, for I don't in the least know why you should."
"Haven't you a little plan that you think rather well of?"
And the Countess nodded at the sequestered couple. Madame Merle's eyes took the same direction. Then she looked serenely at her neighbor.
"You think me more calculating than I am."
"I'm not sure of that. You're capable of anything, you and Osmond. I don't mean Osmond by himself, and I don't mean you by yourself. But together you're dangerous, like some chemical combination."
"You had better leave us alone, then," smiled Madame Merle. "I don't see what has got into your head."
"I've seen this girl but once, but I like her."
Madame Merle hesitated a moment.
"I don't think she likes you."
The Countess's face was set in a grimace.
"Oh, you are dangerous, even by yourself."
"If you want her to like you, don't abuse your brother to her," said Madame Merle.
"I don't suppose you pretend she has fallen in love with him in two intervals."
Madame Merle looked a moment at Isabel and at the master of the house. He was leaning against the parapet, facing her, his arms folded. And she, at present, was evidently not lost in the mere impersonal view, persistently as she gazed at it, while listening to him.
"Yes, I think so," she pronounced.
Gilbert Osmond came to see Isabel again. That is, he came to Palazzo Crescentini. Mrs. Touchett noted the fact that in the course of a fortnight he called 5 times. When she observed to Ralph that it was plain what Mr. Osmond was thinking of, Ralph replied that he was quite of her opinion. "I trust she won't have the folly to listen to him," Mrs. Touchett said to her son. To which Ralph replied that Isabel's listening was one thing and Isabel's answering quite another. Mrs. Touchett also expressed her fears to Madame Merle.
"You who know everything must know whether that curious creature's really making love to my niece."
"Gilbert Osmond?" Madame Merle widened her eyes. "Heaven help us! That's an idea!"
"Hadn't it occurred to you?"
"You make me feel like an idiot, but I confess it hadn't."
"Well, I shall ask Isabel," said Mrs. Touchett.
Madame Merle reflected.
"Don't be too quick with her. Don't inflame her imagination."
"I never did anything in life to anyone's imagination. But Mr. Osmond has nothing the least solid to offer."
Madame Merle smiled. "He's a man who in favorable conditions might very well make a great impression."
"Precisely why I wish he would cease his visits," cried Mrs. Touchett.
At Palazzo Crescentini, Mr. Osmond's manner remained the same, diffident at first,
oh, self-conscious beyond doubt, and full of the effort to overcome this disadvantage, an effort which usually resulted in a great deal of easy, lively, very positive, rather aggressive, always suggestive talk. Henrietta Stackpole arrived in Florence in the middle of May. Madame Merle surveyed her with a single glance, and after a pang of despair, determined to endure her. Henrietta was joined by Mr. Bantling, who arrived from Nice. After an emotional reunion with Henrietta, this gentleman candidly confessed in private to Ralph Touchett that he liked Miss Stackpole extremely. He thought she had a wonderful head on her shoulders, and he found great comfort in the society of a woman who did not perpetually care about what she did or what would be said about her. Henrietta's prospects had brightened since leaving England, and she had sent many letters to the interviewer. She had spent 2 months in Venice, and her present purpose was to get down to Rome. Mr. Bantling was to go with her, and Ralph had the happy idea of proposing to Isabel that she also, under his own escort, should make the pilgrimage. Isabel, in truth, needed no urging, and the party of four arranged its little journey. One of Isabel's preparations consisted of her seeing Gilbert Osmond before she departed.
"I should like to be in Rome with you,"
he commented. She scarcely faltered. "You might come then."
"But you'll have a lot of people with you."
"Ah," Isabel admitted, "of course I shall not be alone." For a moment he said nothing more.
"If I were to go, what should I do with my little girl?"
"Bring her with you," said Isabel promptly. Mr. Osmond looked grave.
"She is too young to make journeys of pleasure."
"You don't like to bring her forward?" Isabel inquired.
"No. I think young girls should be kept out of the world."
"I was brought up on a different system."
"You? Oh, with you it succeeded because you were exceptional."
"I don't see why," said Isabel, who, however, was not sure there was not some truth in the speech. After Isabel had left Florence, Gilbert Osmond met Madame Merle at the Countess Gemini's.
"She wants me to go to Rome while she is there,"
Osmond remarked in a low voice.
"I suppose you mean that you proposed it and she assented."
"Of course, I gave her a chance, but she's encouraging. She's very encouraging."
"I rejoice to hear it, but don't pretend you don't enjoy it."
"The girl's not disagreeable,"
Osmond quietly conceded.
"Is that all you can find to say about that fine creature?"
"All? Isn't it enough? I like her very much. She's all you described her, and into the bargain capable, I feel, of great devotion. She has only one fault."
"What's that?"
"Too many ideas."
"I warned you she was clever."
"Fortunately, they're bad ones," said Osmond.
"Why is that fortunate?"
"Naturally, if they must be sacrificed."
Isabel's impression of Rome was such as might have been expected of a person of her freshness and her eagerness. She had always been fond of history, and here was history in the stones of the street and the atoms of the sunshine. By her own measure, she was very happy. She would even have been willing to take these hours for the happiest she was ever to know. The friends had gone one afternoon. It was the third of their stay, to look at the excavations in the forum. Henrietta wandered away with Mr. Bantling, whom it was apparently delightful to her to hear speak of Julius Caesar as a
cheeky old boy,
and Ralph addressed such elucidations as he was prepared to offer to the attentive ear of our heroine. One of the humble archaeologists who hover about the place had put himself at the disposal of the two, and he told them of a new digging that was on view nearby. Isabel was weary with much wandering, but she persuaded her companion to satisfy his curiosity while she rested. But she was not alone for long. She looked up and saw a gentleman. A gentleman who was not Ralph come back to say that the excavations were a bore. This personage was as startled as she was startled.
"Lord Warburton!" Isabel exclaimed as she rose.
"Miss Archer, I had no idea it was you."
She looked about her to explain. "My cousin's gone to look at the work over there."
"Ah, I see,"
said Lord Warburton vaguely.
"I'm alone. I had no idea you were in Rome. I've only just arrived from the East."
"You've been making a long journey," said Isabel, who had learned from Ralph of Lord Warburton's travels.
"Yes, I came abroad for 6 months, soon after I saw you last. I've been in Turkey and Asia Minor."
He managed not to be awkward, but he wasn't easy.
"Do you wish me to leave you?"
"I don't wish you to leave me, Lord Warburton. I'm very glad to see you."
"Thank you for saying that."
He repeated more than once that he had not expected to meet her.
"I've written to you several times."
"Written to me? I've never had your letters."
"I never sent them. I burned them up."
"Ah," laughed Isabel. "It was better that you should do that than I."
"I thought you wouldn't care for them,"
he went on, with a simplicity that touched her. "I should have been very glad to have news of you. You know how I hope that... But she stopped. There would be such a flatness in the utterance of her thought. "Let's not talk of all that." They walked along a little way in silence. Lord Warburton made for the moment no further reference to their great question, but resumed the conversation by telling Isabel about his travels. On her mentioning the limit of her stay in Rome, he declared he was glad it was still so distant.
"But you won't like that,"
he said.
"You'll be afraid you'll see too much of me."
"Well, I certainly can't expect you to leave this delightful place on my account, but I confess I'm afraid of you."
"Afraid I'll begin again? I promise I'll never say a word to displease you."
"Very good. If you do, our friendship's at an end."
"Perhaps someday, after a while, you'll give me leave."
"Give you leave to make me unhappy?" He hesitated.
"To tell you again..."
But he checked himself.
"I'll keep it down. I'll keep it down. Always."
Ralph Touchett had been joined at the excavation by Miss Stackpole and her attendant, and these three now emerged from among the mounds of earth and came into sight of Isabel and her companion. Poor Ralph hailed his friend with joy qualified by wonder, and Henrietta exclaimed in a high voice, "Gracious, there's that lord!" Mr. Bantling took occasion to nod to his lordship, who answered him with a friendly,
"Oh, you here, Bantling?"
and a handshake.
"Well," said Henrietta, "I didn't know you knew him."
"I guess you don't know everyone I know,"
Mr. Bantling rejoined facetiously.
"I thought when an Englishman knew a lord, he always told you so."
The next day was Sunday, and it had been agreed among our friends that they would drive together to the great church of St. Peter's for Vespers. The church was crowded when they arrived, but the service had not yet begun. Ralph and Henrietta became separated, and Isabel found herself following Lord Warburton. Suddenly, Gilbert Osmond appeared at her side.
"So you decided to come," she said, stopping and putting out her hand.
"Yes, I came last night. I called this afternoon at your hotel, and they told me you'd come here."
"The others are about," she decided to say.
"I didn't come for the others."
She looked away. Lord Warburton was watching them. Perhaps he had heard this. Fortunately, at this moment, Mr. Bantling emerged, cleaving the crowd with British valor, and followed by Miss Stackpole and Ralph Touchett. Ralph appeared disturbed on seeing the gentleman from Florence.
He didn't hang back, however, from civility, and presently observed to Isabel with due benevolence that she would soon have all her friends about her. Miss Stackpole had met Mr. Osmond in Florence, but she had already found occasion to say to Isabel that she liked him no better than her other admirers. Lord Warburton joined Ralph Touchett, and the two strolled away together.
Who's the fellow speaking to Miss Archer?
His name's Gilbert Osmond. He lives in Florence, Ralph said.
Does she like him?
Do you mean will she accept him?
Yes,
said Lord Warburton after an instant.
I suppose that's what I horribly mean.
Perhaps not, if one does nothing to prevent it, Ralph replied.
His lordship stared a moment, but apprehended,
Then we must be perfectly quiet?
As quiet as the grave.
Is he awfully clever?
Awfully.
And what else?
What more do you want? Ralph groaned.
Do you mean, what more does she?
Ralph took him by the arm to turn him. They had to rejoin the others.
She wants nothing that we can give her. Oh, well, if she won't have you,
said his lordship handsomely.